You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
Welcome to Washington Post Live. I'm Michael Shearer, national political reporter at the Washington Post. My guest today is Kellyanne Conway, the 2016 campaign manager for Donald Trump, who later served for almost four entire years at the White House as a senior advisor and now working as a pollster for Republicans. Welcome to Washington Post Live, Kellyanne.
Nice to see you, Mike. How are you?
I'm well. But I want to start back in 2016. You played a pretty central role in 2016 in recommending Mike Pence to be the running mate of future President Trump. Your argument then was that Trump needed to pick someone from the Midwest, someone from the Rust Belt, someone who could help break the blue wall, which he successfully did. This time around, you're saying he should pick a person of color. So the question is, what's changed?
I'm saying many things. I wrote a lengthy op-ed in the New York Times a couple months ago. People can pull it up. It's called Who Should Be President Trump's Number Two. I named probably 15 people in there. There are people I would put on President Trump's long short list who weren't in my op-ed, like Senator Bill Hagerty of Tennessee, for example. I know there are people in President Trump's ear about putting RFK Jr. on his ticket and really crowding out Biden's ability to win back so many of those disaffected Democrats that were purged from the Democratic Party because they purged RFK Jr. from the Democratic Party and forced him to run as an independent. But in my op-ed, I make the argument I would make now, which is, yes, it sounds great for him to pick a woman. That would be wonderful. I'm all for women rising in this country, particularly in politics and elsewhere. But he doesn't need to do that. We are all paying the costs and consequences daily of Joe Biden. Clear, he would only pick a woman. And if you look at even Kamala Harris's, Vice President Harris's public schedule, it doesn't seem to be much on it most days and most weeks. So President Trump can pick a woman if he wants. But as I reminded him, and as I make the case to you, Michael, Donald Trump beat the would-be first female president in the United States of America, Hillary Clinton, when a majority of the voters were female. We've basically been a majority of the electorate since presidential electorate since about 1964. So I think putting us all in these little demographic boxes based on race or age or gender, socioeconomic status, geography, even past political behavior is limited. And 2024 is probably the year that will show that in a major way. I do believe that Donald Trump will have monster returns, monster gains among some of the minority populations, particularly Hispanic, if not African-American males. And all the polling shows that. And so if he has a Marco Rubio or a Byron Donalds, a Ben Carson, certainly a Tim Scott on the ticket, that could obviously help in what is already happening, which is a migration away from the Democratic Party by some of its core constituents over to President Trump in some of the major polls. There are other people I mentioned in the op-ed, like Mike Pompeo, Tom Cotton, people I think who would be seen as Mark be in that category, Katie Britt, Marsha Blackburn. I think there's no end to the choices that Donald Trump has. But I will say my argument in 2016 for Mike Pence was that Mike Pence could help with evangelical Christians and other church-going folks who were didn't really know a lot about President Trump's Mr. Trump's politics, maybe concerned about how he would be with the federal courts, concerned how he might be on abortion and life. And also, it was really about geography and electoral votes. You know, politics, Michael, is not about biology or even chemistry. It's about math and science. You need more electoral votes than the other person. And Mike Pence or Scott Walker, Terry Branstad, maybe John Kasich, maybe Rick Snyder at the time, all Republican governors of these states of which I speak, states that Barack Obama gave all the other states I just mentioned. And Hillary's blue wall was real. I think now it's less and more about who will not be a distraction for Donald Trump on the ticket, who will help him win, who will help him govern, and who can step in and be ready on day one.
Let me ask you, we're having some technical difficulties with the feed, but we'll just power through it. But let me ask you about Mike Pence. He has taken a pretty sharp turn in recent weeks after running against Trump for the nomination. He wrote an op-ed that said he won't endorse Trump for the ticket because Trump is, quote, pursuing an agenda that is at odds with the conservative agenda we governed on. Does Mike Pence have a point?
Well, that's Mike Pence's point. He's welcome to make it. And I'm very happy that he served 4 years as a very dutiful, loyal, respectful, and aligned, I think that's very important, policy aligned vice president. I know as fact when Vice President Pence disagreed with the direction or maybe some of the staff level advice or cabinet level advice that President Trump was receiving on a particular issue, that Vice President Pence expressed that hesitation or that disagreement with the president privately, and that's really the way to do it. And so what I think they had 4 years of a very successful administration, particularly pre-COVID, but even then when Mike Pence took on the very difficult task of heading up it was called the Coronavirus Task Force. Soon after that, it would be known more, I think, popularly or publicly as COVID-19. But we were in that situation room every day, listening to the doctors, listening to private sector, public sector, trying to get this right. And it was Vice President Pence who was in charge of that. So he is welcome to disagree. I think that there is an argument to be made for a federal minimum standard, not a ban, as all of you like to say, because you know ban's a four-letter word, but a federal minimum standard on abortion. And the reason that is because if you're a President Trump and you have very succinctly and I would say consistently said that your own position on abortion is you are pro-life with exceptions for rape or incest conceptions, or in the case of life of the mother instances, and you start with those three exceptions, and even President Trump has said he thinks 6 weeks is too early, he thinks 10 weeks is too early. So if he feels that way, then the 10 or 12 states where there is abortion only to save the life of the mother, including you saw Governor Noem over the weekend being asked questions like that. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, you have states like California or Illinois or New York or New Jersey or Colorado, where these are very permissive, practically to the point of birth or definitely past the point of viability. I think that to have a national minimum standard far before that is something that is wise. When I hear people in Washington say, this is only a state issue, Washington should have no role here. Well, number one, President Biden and Vice President Harris just in the last 2 weeks have said, well, Washington does have a role. The vice president doesn't do that much, but she went all the way to Arizona and got abortion. President Biden just this week had behind him Restore Roe, shaking hands with Roe, something about reproductive health. So they want this to be a federal issue. And I would just say to those who say there is no federal role, well, then why are you talking about school choice or school board elections or policing and crime? I mean, those are quintessentially local issues. We want everybody in Washington to talk about everything, meaning, Michael, it's important for those in power to at least bring voice and visibility to the issues that Americans say are vexing and perplexing them. I'm not surprised that Vice President Pence, who ran for president against President Trump this last time, disagrees on some issues. I think they also disagree on TikTok. Vice President Pence, through his Advancing America, has laid down a lot of money, seven-figure budget, running ads, supporting the ban of TikTok and its sale to an American company. President Trump has been very forward-facing, saying he's against that. He put it on Truth Social yesterday, the day before, just saying, don't make these other tech companies more powerful. That's where people will go. And I think he's pointing out the irony, if not the hypocrisy, that President Biden's campaign is on TikTok. And yet President Biden has said, put the TikTok ban on my desk and I'll sign it into law.
I want to come back to TikTok, but before we leave abortion, you were pretty outspoken in 22 about Republicans needing to speak more about abortion after the overturning of Roe v. Wade. It wasn't a successful year, I think, in 22 in a lot of races. Democrats were able to get the upper hand. I think the sense I have from Republicans, you even look at some of the Senate candidates, Carrie Lake in Arizona, Dave McCormick in Pennsylvania, they have shifted their abortion positions from 22. Like Trump, they seem wary of being seen as, you know, a vote for me as a vote for restriction of abortion. How do you assess where Republicans are as a whole? Like, what is the downside of not taking a stand on 15 weeks or not being more vocal on the issue now? It appears to me that what happened in 22 is sort of happening again.
First of all, people should say what they believe and stick with it. That's upon someone, regardless of the issue, you should stick with what you believe and keep articulating that. Otherwise, you get yourself in trouble, and you're not being, you're not being honest about your own position. But the question you're asking me, and the question you're asking Carrie Lake and Dave McCormick and Donald Trump and the rest of them, you really should ask the Democrats. I would like to ask the Democrats and whoever debates Vice President Harris in what we hope will be at least one vice presidential debate, Michael, should ask her. Vice President Harris, in your own home state of California, abortion is basically allowed anytime, anywhere, anyone, during any point in a normal pregnancy, to at least acknowledge science. Forget about your religion and morality for a moment or why you feel this way, but can I get you to acknowledge science? Science has shown us in the state of California and elsewhere that a baby can feel pain at 15 weeks, 20 weeks. There are, if you talk to surgeons that perform in vitro procedures on fetuses, they work on the hearts, the brains. Dr. Ben Carson has told me this. They anesthetize the unborn fetus, the unborn baby, at 15 weeks, sometimes earlier. And the only reason you and I get anesthesia, Michael, is if we can feel pain. So I think that's a sort of softer way of approaching this. And I believe the Democrats are becoming science deniers. I would ask Vice President Harris, can you come from 39 weeks, maybe over to, say, 24 weeks, where babies are being born in the state of California, surviving and thriving? Can you come at a point in which babies in your own state now, they have names, they're part of the census of California, like you are, Vice President Harris? California. And I think that's a very good way to approach it. We never hear what, they don't seem to have any exceptions. And so I think it's a very important question to be asking both sides. And whether it's 15 weeks, 12 weeks, 10 weeks, 6 weeks, 24 weeks, I just believe these candidates should be forward facing, tell you what they believe, why they believe that, and stick with it. But this was my criticism in 2022, and it is my warning in 2024 for those not listening and taking what I think is not my advice, but solid advice, is not necessarily my advice, but it is solid advice, which is this. If you are just hiding under your desk, hoping the shrapnel won't hit you, you're not listening to vote. It took 50 years to overturn Roe versus Wade. It's going to take more than hours, or indeed 50 weeks, to explain to people what that means. People were afraid. They were angry. They were frustrated. They were outraged. And some folks ran to the states and did these initiatives. We didn't take a penny from any of them. I thought many of them were poorly handled. I've said that many times. I'll say it again. They were poorly handled because you're not explaining to people what they would do and what they wouldn't do. And if in Kansas, the name of the initiative is, quote, no state constitutional right to an abortion, that's going to be hard to pass. If in Michigan, it's unfairly and deceptively named reproductive freedom for all, that's going to be hard to defeat. So people need to wise up, and I believe you have to understand that, understand where people are, understand where the consensus is. And then, Michael, everybody's polling shows there is a consensus when you talk about either no abortion ever, that's a very small percentage of the population, like 8 or 9%, or to save life for the mother, or in cases of rape or incest, conceptions. And then if you add the Dobbs fact pattern to that 15 weeks, let's just call it roughly the first trimester, you're up to about 70% of the country.
Yeah, that's actually a good segue.
Again, I just feel like those who are controlling. Yeah.
I was just gonna say, it's a good segue to a viewer question we got, and I wanna read it to you, like to bring in the viewers. Donna Rapetsky of Virginia writes, where do you see the abortion issue headed in the future, say in 10 years? Do you feel like this is on its way to settling out after the initial shock of the court's ruling?
It's a great question, Donna, partly because you do see some states like Florida where there's an initiative, a ballot initiative this time, that if passed would make abortion more permissive than it was pre-Dobbs and during Roe. As I read that initiative in its current form, it doesn't have guardrails. It doesn't have reasonable restrictions or regulation, past viability, et cetera. So it looks like it's in response to 6 weeks, but actually would be more permissive than what Florida had previously. So I think the pendulum may swing in a few places to a point where people say, well, hold on, that doesn't match science. And I believe the debate over abortion, Donna, 10, 20 years ago about the woman and mostly about religion and morality, your core beliefs of when life begins. And of course, those are still incredibly central to the conversation, whether it's between you and me right now around kitchen tables and cappuccino counters, or in the U.S. Congress or in our state houses. But the conversation now also includes science. People see fetal development. They know the sex of their baby fairly on. They see the heartbeat with their own eyes. They see the brain development. And those who look at those who knew enough about science, which is where I think some of this debate is headed and should be headed, if people wise up and know and say, this is what I see, not what you say. I know what I see with my own two eyes. Folks can say, look, you knew enough about science, to mask up a five-year-old for the better parts of the beginning of two school years. But you look at a five-month-old sonogram and you're pretending that you don't see the male organ or the baby sucking its thumb or waving back at you. So I think that we're headed that way as well. And I really am trying, as somebody who is pro-life, I am trying very hard to listen to both sides and try to turn down the temperature so that we can build a culture of life, by understanding, face and feel alone, feel frightened, but they should know they've got a number of choices. I think pro-lifers need to be pro-life for the child's entire life. I think that when we talk about adoption and foster care, we should be on the front lines of making that more available for people. People should understand that there are resources available to them if they find themselves in unintended pregnancies. And this whole idea that we're taking the word abortion, you just said it, but you know, Joe Biden couldn't even say the word in his entire State of the Union address. Kamala Harris will hardly say it. They've got these euphemisms like women's health. Well, where's cardiovascular disease and cancer and the major killers of women too? In other words, and the major health challenges. Like, we can't just say women's health and mean abortion, or freedom and just mean abortion. And I fear that we, Michael, are reducing ourselves in this election to talk about, quote, women's issues. I believe all issues are women's issues. I believe that we women can handle all of the issues: economy, war, healthcare, abortion, crime, the border, education, you name it. I know we can handle it.
You brought up.
It's offensive to hear women's issues when, and I've never heard the term men's issues a single time. Right.
Yeah, that was something you brought up both in 2016, I think, and in it was one of your criticisms of the 2020 campaign and the campaign leadership in 2020, which you wrote about some in your book. I wonder, you're now on the outside looking in. You mentioned that you still talk to the former president. How do you feel like the campaign leadership now for President Trump is doing as compared to what was there in 2020?
Trump's 2024 campaign as the best of both worlds in this way. I feel like President Trump and his campaign have grabbed back the hunger, the swagger, the underdog, underestimated Donald Trump. He's at his best when that's the ethos and frankly, the day by day. But you couple that with a presidential record, and then you're able to say to America, this is a binary choice. That it's life with Donald Trump as president, life under Joe Biden as president, you make the choice. And people will make the choice. Some people will say, I was much better off economically. And ironically, there was less chaos and crisis around the world and at the southern border. Donald Trump was the first president to not start a new war in 72 years. I like the energy independence. I like being net exporters of natural gas and oil for the first time versus the war on fossil fuels now. Or you can say, look, I prefer Joe Biden and Kamala Harris as my president, vice president, but at least you can compare. And I believe that Donald Trump was able to become, his resurgence was not created by, so much cemented by, a lot of what voters see as prosecution as persecution, but it was created by the fact that he had this record. And you know, Michael, we all have the same bias in hiring, whether it's why you got hired by Time Magazine and then the Washington Post, why I get hired, or why we hire people. And it's this: we like to hire people to do a job who have already done that job. That way we can see their product, their work product. We can talk to the references. We can look at the resume. We can interview them. And in essence, that's what the country has done with these two candidates. It's the first time in almost ever, certainly modern times, that we can look at the record of two sitting president or two immediate past president and sitting president, and suss it out and assess it for ourselves. So what? I like the fact that it's a tight team that doesn't, I think President Trump loves when his quote, people are on TV. But I think the principals of this campaign, particularly Susie Wiles and Chris LaCivita, have decided not to be on TV. I know they talk to the press a lot, particularly one of them. And so they definitely have their voice out there. Caroline Leavitt's doing a fantastic job as the president's spokeswoman. And he's got, you know, and he makes sure that he's front facing for the cameras as well.
But under what conditions would you, you've left open the possibility of sort of rejoining his orbit. Under what conditions would you consider doing that?
Well, I have a contributor contract with Fox News, and I promise them so long as I am there, like exclusively as a contributor, that I will not work on a presidential race. And I have to see what my best and highest use is for everyone concerned, and that seems to be on the outside. I do remain close with President Trump. I do speak with him regularly, and he knows that. Well, I can say one of the dumbest things ever said about him, and there's plenty that probably right now as we're sitting here, is that he likes a bunch of yes men and yes men around him. That's just not true. He abhors obsequiousness. And a lot of those folks have fallen out of favor. Many of them are now never Trumpers, which is funny in its own way. But I guess money talks. And it helps people grow their own consciousness. But that alone, I would say, is why we remain close. I'm very happy to deliver tough news, but I do it privately and respectfully. And also, we just have muscle memory. And I think his 2016 campaign was that come from behind Donald Trump, underfunded, understaffed, underdog, underestimated. I'm glad he's not understaffed or underfunded this time, for sure. But my criticism of 2020, and the only reason I'm saying it is because it needs to be avoided again. And I hear everybody say, well, I don't think Donald Trump's going to have the same resources as Joe Biden. That's okay, because I don't think Joe Biden can use his money to allay so many concerns that even come from Democrats and certainly majorities of independents in everybody's polling, including Washington Post polling, which is people are genuinely concerned about their lack of confidence in Joe Biden's competence, the agility, the ability, the acuity. These are real questions that people have, to say nothing of a nagging concerns over the chaotic and immediate withdrawal from Afghanistan and everything that's left behind. I mean, what's the point of having the first female vice president if the women of Afghan are less free because her and her boss did what they did? Right. The new wars, the border, there's a lot of churn right now. And yeah. I say that because Donald Trump in 2020, Michael, as you know, they had $1.6 billion, and they proved the old adage to be true, that you take that the fastest way to make a small fortune is to have a large one and waste most of it. And they did, and they ran out of money toward the end to have ads in these swing states. So that needs to be avoided.
I have just a couple minutes left, and I want to try and squeeze in two more questions. You mentioned a bunch of Trump's policy accomplishments in his term in office. Something was not on the ballot in 2020 was what happened afterwards, his denial of the election result, the horrible events of January 6th and his role in that. You were clear inside the White House, as I understand it, that there wasn't that he had lost, and that if the court challenges didn't succeed, he wouldn't be president again. How will that play a role in this year's election? Like how will voters take that in? How do you think that will affect the results this time?
It may. And it may depend on the outcome of some of these cases, but I think that's all being litigated in real time, because we had a January 6th congressional committee. We have January 6th investigation federally. We have other investigations federally and in the state court in the case of Fulton County, which of course now is a mess, man-made mess there, of course, as it usually is. But so all of that's been litigated in real time. We see the January 6th defendants get their sentences. I think I read about another one yesterday. What hasn't been litigated, and this is a big wild card, is everything we've learned about the Biden family, because President Biden lied at the debate when he was very clearly asked by the moderator, did you ever talk to your son about business? What about his laptop? And he said there's 51 national security experts who have said this, it has the hallmarks of Russian disinformation. They've debunked that. I've never talked to my son. I love my son, et cetera. We know that's not true now. And so I think that will be litigated. I think that there's so much under coverage, Michael, of how how much of Joe's approval ratings and his inability to kind of turn that around and turn Vice President Harris's approval ratings around. There's a lot of that that's baked in that has an awful lot to do with people's swirling questions about whether he's been transparent and truthful.
Okay, let me get back
what
to
what happened.
The last question I got to try and squeeze in here. I said I'd come back to TikTok. You were resistant of the legislation that I think is going to be signed today or has already been signed today that calls for either a sale or a ban of TikTok. What do you think the harm is of what the House, the Senate, and the President have done today? And can you explain what damage you think will come from this decision to ban this app because of national security concerns?
Sure. Let me start out by saying China is a bad actor. They should be held to account. And the question is, how are we holding them to account? Do we know the origins of the COVID virus? Has that been verified? Do we know it won't happen again in some form or fashion? Are the Uyghurs a religious minority? They're still being persecuted. Is fentanyl still the number one killer of 18 to 45 year olds and pouring in from China over our borders through our mails and other ways? And the list goes on and on. And we actually tested that. So I don't work for TikTok and I'm not a lobbyist. So headlines like that are just clickbait. But I am against a ban of TikTok. And I think that it will be gummed up in litigation almost immediately. There are First Amendment concerns, there are a bill of attainder concerns, maybe 14th Amendment concerns. And so I think it will be slowed down. I pointed out earlier, I'll say it again. Yeah, I suppose President Biden is going to sign the ban into law, but keep his campaign on TikTok until it takes effect. So everybody should see that. If TikTok, by the way, is truly burning the brains and the bodies of my four teenagers, three of whom are female, then I said this to senators before. I said it to a very prominent Democratic senator. I said it to a very prominent Republican senator. I said, if it's truly burning the brains and the bodies of my teenagers, I demand that you all return tonight. This is over a year ago, which tells you, makes my point. And passed by unanimous consent, this has to stop immediately. I think there are ways to ensure, like Project Texas and other measures, to ensure that 170 million U.S. users of TikTok monthly, of which I'm not one, I'm not on TikTok, and I'm not on Facebook or Instagram for that matter, but I think you should be if it's legal. We're telling 170 million U.S. users, we're protecting you now. We didn't protect you before, but we're protecting you now, and we have to rip the app from you. So I think it's going to be immediately litigated. I think people were thumping their chest to say, look what we did. We held China to account. And yet it's going to be immediately litigated. You know how I know this? There's a state called Montana. They banned it about a year ago, last May. It has never gone into effect. It was immediately litigated, not just by ByteDance or TikTok or whoever sued, but by Montanans. And so they feel that it's an encroachment. I'm always concerned when there's kind of groupthink in Washington, D.C. And I saw it here. By the way, Marco Rubio himself, Senator Rubio, who I have at the top of Donald Trump's, you know, long short list for VP, near the top, he was one of the authors, I think, of the original, you know, ban TikTok. I think he's a ranking member on Intelligence Committee, along with Senator Mark Warner, the Democrat. And he voted against that bill last night. He voted against, I think, because it doesn't do anything for the border. But in the end, even someone like that voted against. But we'll see what happens. Okay. And Michael, you know, in terms of, we didn't talk about polls, which is what I do for a living. We didn't talk about, here's the deal, my memoir is still on sale, number one, New York Times bestseller. But I do hope that we can all get less rosy, sunny polling this time. I was a big critic of rosy, sunny polling in 2022 also, whether it was pollsters on the right saying everybody was winning, every Republican was winning everywhere, big red wave. That was silly. We were ranked A-minus top, 91% accuracy by Nate Silver's 538 in a year of terrible polling. And the Washington Post and ABC News showed that ridiculous poll showing Joe Biden winning Wisconsin by 17 points came out of the field on October 25th. You can't do that stuff. Wisconsin is never going to show Joe Biden or Donald Trump up by 17 points. It is the swingiest of swing states. They each won it by less than a percentage point, 2016, 2020. I think we should all agree to not use polling as a weapon to try to help people, because we don't want that. We want a pure and fair election where the people decide who their next president is.
Okay, we'll leave it there with the plug. I did enjoy your book, but unfortunately we're out of time.
Thank you. Polling. Take care, everyone.
Thank you
Take
very care. Much for joining us, Kellyanne.
Happy spring. You got it. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to WashingtonPostLive.com.